Everyone for this morning.
I know, I haven't even had a chance to vote on it.
Okay.
Yeah. First inning.
Welcome, everyone, to the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Today is February 21st. We are going to get a couple of work things out of the way before we move into to informational meetings and public hearings. So first, I want to just state for the record that we're going to carry over the work session on House Bills 2216, 2500, 2401, and 2221. These are human service bills that we heard a few days ago. In one case, we're still waiting on an amendment. And in the other three cases, we've got fiscals that we want more understanding of before we try to move them out of this committee. So we will be talking more with DHS and some of the advocates about the fiscals that came back. And we hope to work those as soon as possible. So if you're in the room for the purpose of those, and that's all, you can feel free to go. Do I need to gavel in or out on that, carrying those over? Okay. I do want to gavel in for the purpose of introduction of committee bills. And I want to say before we even introduce these that these are being introduced by the committee, and if you vote for yes, we want to hear these as bills, that is in no way an indication of your support for these bills. We understand you. We have had no public testimony. You may have no idea where you're going to end up on these. It is only for the purpose of the committee getting to hear these what these bills are. And I, after hearing a motion on the bills, I will explain a little bit about what I know about them. So.
Chair Kinnegaier, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 3145, dated 12/15/16, and LC 2062, dated 2/9/17. It says 16. Oh, how funny! Yeah. I just read it.
I think the second one was LC 40.
No, it's 2/5/15/16. That is one.
Oh, that's the date.
That's the date.
And then
LC 4062.
Okay, great. Rep. Sanchez moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 3145, dated 12/15/16, and LC 4062, dated 2/9/17. So before we take a vote on that, I just want to explain that LC 3145 is a capital gains exemption that would go to it restructures how we do capital gains when we're trying to incentivize manufactured home park owners to sell to people who live there. So we've tried to incentivize that when there's a sale of manufactured home parks. We want the owner, the people who live there, to have an opportunity to buy it. And in order to incentivize that, we've given a capital gains tax exemption to the property owner in order to incentivize that. But that only works if they pay income tax in Oregon. And some of these parks are owned by out-of-state people, and we want to make sure that this incentive works for people that own the manufactured home parks outside of Oregon. So it's really a technical fix. It came from the speaker, and you know, I think people don't want to put their names on a ton of bills that are kind of technical fixes, but that's where that came from. And the second one, 4062, is allowing counties to have the opportunity to lower, to exempt low-income property tax if they're trying to pass a property tax bond for public safety or for school bonds or something like that. They should have the ability to say, you know, we're going to exempt any properties under $50,000 in order to not hurt people who are very low income. Frankly, this particular bill may end up going straight to revenue and not to us. This came from somebody from a rural area where this has been a concern in the past. So that is what I know about those two bills. And at this point, I'd like to see if there's any discussion on those bills, on those. Yes.
Yeah, Chair Kinnegaier, I just wanted to say, Rep. Sanchez, that was a fine job making your first motion.
Yeah. Oh, thanks.
Okay. Any other discussion on those LCs? Any objection to introducing those as committee bills? Okay. Thank you. Seeing none, those are you will be seeing those as committee bills. Okay, so we're going to move to a public hearing now. I'm going to open it on House Bill 2852. And Representative Leininger, would you, Cassie, please read the summary of the 2852?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2852 extends the sunset date for affordable housing lenders' tax credit to January 1st, 2026. The bill also increases the total amount of tax credits allowed for all taxpayers per fiscal year to $34 million. The bill is effective 91 days following signee die.
Before you start, Representative Leininger, I'm also going to open up House Bill 2070 simultaneously. That was the bill that we previously heard when Chris Alanek gave us some background on the tax credits. That one simply extends the for another 6 years our housing tax credit, and 2852 would double the cap.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, I'm Ann Leininger, State Representative for House District 38, and I'm really happy to be here today to talk about expansion of a tool that is one of many good ideas before you this session to expand access to affordable housing. This tool expands the supply of affordable housing, which is an important strategy, among others, that we're looking at this legislative session. For around 10 years, I worked in the affordable housing sector as a nonprofit developer, as a lawyer for nonprofit affordable housing developers, and then as a funder, and then as a county commissioner, actually, so a little bit longer than that. So I've worked with this issue for a long time, and I have seen the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit be a really useful tool in expanding the supply. Since 1989, the OAHTC, as it's called, has helped build 16,852 units of affordable housing, 41% of which are in rural areas. It's an efficient tool that sparks job creation in the construction sector, in addition to increasing the supply of housing. Many tax credits expire and renew every year, but the OAHTC cycles when loan payments are made, and it's operating really close to the margin, the cap right now, which makes it difficult for developers to use it. That's why expanding the cap would be great, and it would expanding the cap to $34 million would leverage an additional $425 million of private debt to support construction projects, creating both jobs and additional units. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to people more knowledgeable than me to carry forward the conversation. But thanks for all the work that you're doing this session on affordable housing strategies. I hope you'll give this expansion close attention.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Leininger? Thank you, Representative. Okay, so we have up first Allison McIntosh, Terry McDonald, and Joni Hartman.
Good morning, Chair Kinnegar, Vice Chair Stark, Vice Chair Sanchez, members of the committee. My name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Housing Alliance. Thank you for your time this morning. As I said last week, the Oregon Housing Alliance is a coalition of more than 80 organizations from all parts of the state, and our members know that housing opportunity is the foundation on which all of our success is built. Individual success as students, parents, workers, and community members, as well as the success of our communities. And we represent a diverse set of voices, including residents, local jurisdictions, nonprofit housing developers, and organizations working to meet basic needs in every corner of the state. We believe that all Oregonians need a safe, stable place to call home, and as you will hear today, we simply don't have enough affordable homes for people who need them. One in four renters in Oregon pays more than half of their income towards rent, leaving too little left over for food, medicine, transportation, and other basic needs. When we are able to provide housing for people that need it, it has important and significant benefits. Kids are stable in school and able to focus on things that matter, being kids, doing their homework, and not worrying about where their families will sleep at night. Parents are able to focus on their work and taking care of kids. Everyone's stress decreases and health improves. and safe and stable housing is the key to helping people access opportunity. We can do more to provide opportunity for all Oregonians, and as you will hear today, we have a strong network of affordable housing developers across Oregon, and with more resources like the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, we can build more affordable homes for Oregonians who need them. The Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, or OAHTC, is a proven and effective tool, and since 1989, as Representative Leininger has said, it has helped to build over 16,000 units and provide thousands of Oregonians with safe, stable housing by directly lowering the rents. The credit provides a long-term benefit and keeps rent lowered for tenants for 20 years. As soon as the project is completed, the credit goes into effect, meaning tenants benefit as soon as they move in. It also helps to preserve and facilitate the helps to preserve existing affordable housing as well as manufactured home parks, which we'll talk a little bit about today. As you know, with all state tax credits, it's scheduled to sunset on a six-year cycle so that it can be reviewed for effectiveness by the legislature. House Bill 2852, which we're here in support of today, both extends the sunset and also expands the cap to $34 million. We really believe this can be an effective tool to help build more affordable housing and preserve existing housing in the midst of this housing crisis, and are asking for your consideration on increasing the cap. I do want to point out before we move on to more testimony, we have some materials submitted in OLIS. I think you might have seen them last week. We have some background information on some of the questions asked by the Joint Tax Credit Committee. We also have a very awesome map of all the projects that have been built over the last, since 1989, with the Affordable Housing Tax Credit, and we also provided a list of projects developed with the OAHTC provided by the department. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I will turn it over to Terry McDonald.
Any questions? Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for giving us the opportunity to advocate for the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit. My name is Terry McDonald. I'm the director of St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County, and I've held that position for the last 34 years. During that tenure, St. Vincent de Paul has kind of expanded beyond its typical roots of emergency services, which we continue to do, and homeless services in our community, where we serve in the Lane County area approximately 84,000 people a year, and every service that you can imagine, from homeless shelters to car camping to food boxes, material assistance of all different types. One of the principal tools that we use, of course, is the development of affordable housing. And affordable housing, we believe, of course, as Homeaton does, is a key cornerstone of a healthy and sustainable economy and communities. And over the last 25 years, St. Vincent de Paul has developed around 1,300 units of affordable housing. Approximately 10 years ago, we became really very aware of the need for the development and preservation of mobile home parks, especially in rural areas. What we found was that mobile home parks are often places of last resort for low-income people to live, and especially in those rural areas. And many of those parks that are in those rural areas, rural Lane County, Southwest Oregon, Eastern Oregon, almost everywhere around the state, there's approximately 120,000 units of affordable housing in the state of Oregon that are mobile homes. What we found was is that those parks are often old, and they're often got very derelict, very marginal housing stock, that often the housing stock is over 50 years old. And as a result of that, it really provides a reservoir of inadequate housing for families. And it's often places where you'll see crime and dysfunctional behavior creep in and cause really a problem for many communities. An example of that was the Oak Ridge Mobile Home Park that St. Vincent de Paul acquired 3 years ago, using Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits, by the way, as one of the key ways of making the park affordable for us to purchase. The Oak Ridge Mobile Home Park was a 60-unit park in Oak Ridge. It accounted for half of the police calls for the city of Oak Ridge, 4 to 5 calls per night. Emergency service providers, medical teams would not go in after night unless they had police escort. And so it was a park that was considered a real eyesore and a problem for the community. St. Vincent de Paul, using the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits, purchased that park, and over the last 3 years have dealt with the crime issues, dealt with a lot of the social dysfunction, replaced about 20 of the units in the park with new units, And as a result of that, that park has turned around, and it now accounts for less than 1% of all the police calls in the city, about 3 or 4 per month. And most of those are domestic disputes rather than drug and alcohol or abuse issues. So the result is that the strategy of using this type of a tool, of a nonprofit acquiring this kind of a park, renovating it, dealing with the social dysfunction, really is a remarkable tool in transformation for a community. But without the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, it takes away one of the primary tools that we have to deal with this kind of a problem. St. Vincent de Paul currently owns 5 parks. We're acquiring 2 more, both of them difficult parks, one of them in Saginaw, Oregon, which it again has a long history of bad behavior. And the other one is Oakleaf Mobile Home Park in off of Killingsworth in Portland. That's a park that, of course, has been in the news actually quite a bit recently because it's a failing park. And what we have seen in that park is, as my social service director says, the worst poverty they have ever seen any place in Oregon. Unless we find a way to deal with these very, very difficult places, unless we find a way to acquire them, preserve them, and turn them into good housing stock for people, we will continue to have the continuing social problems that we all face as a community flooding into the streets, raising more homelessness, more crime, and more issues. This tool that we have with the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits really is a primary tool for us to use in order to try and mitigate the damage associated with these decaying parks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good work.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joni Hartman, and I'm the executive director of the Housing Development Center in Portland. The Housing Development Center provides consulting services to other nonprofits who need assistance in developing affordable housing due to lack of staff capacity or technical knowledge. HDC is a nonprofit whose mission is to strengthen opportunities for low-income families and individuals by developing, preserving, and sustaining affordable housing. Over the last 24 years, HDC has assisted in developing over 5,600 units of affordable housing in Oregon and Washington. And I'm testifying today in support of House Bill 2852. So over HDC's history, as I said, we've developed quite a few units, and we've used a lot of OAHDCs doing that. A few of the recent projects that I want to bring to your attention so you get a sense of what these projects look like. We just wrapped up lease up on a recent project in Oregon called in Portland called Rosewood Plaza. And Rosewood consists of 45 units of affordable housing for families. But in conjunction with that, a 5,000 square foot dental clinic was built and is being operated by Wallace Medical Concern, which provides low income low-cost dental services to low-income individuals. And for some of the residents at this project, that is the first time they've seen a dentist in a very long time. Another project that I want to bring to your attention is a project that I'm working on in Warrenton. This is a project that just recently got awarded its funding and got an allocation of OAHTC. It's a 37-year-old apartment complex called Alder Court, and as you can imagine, after 37 years being on the coast in weather, it's really in need of a rehab. The typical Alder Court resident is a 71-year-old woman living alone with a typical annual income of $13,740. In addition to serving seniors, Alder Court is home to 12 individuals living with disabilities. I was at a resident meeting out at the project last week. There were lots of questions and lots of excitement. We're hoping to start renovation in August of this year, and the residents are excited. And but for Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits, that project would not be moving forward. As people have already mentioned, we are in an unparalleled housing crisis at the moment. Individuals and families are getting displaced by their homes just from increasing rental rates and find it difficult to find a new place to live. And when they do, they're generally spending more of their income towards housing than they did prior. One of our tools in the toolbox for putting together more housing is using Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits. Without the credit, fewer projects would be get built, there'd be fewer homes for families, or there would be a need for greater public capital to bring these projects to fruition. This credit is especially important in rural areas where there are fewer other resources than in general to build this much-needed affordable housing. So prior to coming to HDC, I spent 13 years at Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, which is a consortium lending organization. And so I have a little familiarity with the tax credit. I would say that the OAHDCs are one of the most efficient and effective tools there is for providing affordable housing. The projects that get awarded the credits first have to apply to Oregon Housing. They have to compete. They have to be amongst the best of the best to get awarded. The owners then have to seek out a lender who's willing to take those credits, and then the lender then lowers their interest rate by 4 percentage points, which is a lot. I know we'd all rather have a 2% interest rate than a 6% interest rate on our homes, but that means there's less debt service, there's less that the owners have to pay the lenders, and that means they collect less from the tenants. And that's one of what's written into the statute. Every dollar in interest rate reduction from the tax credit gets passed on through lower rents to the residents. So this is, as I said, one of the most efficient tools out there. Speaking to what, there are two instances where there is not that pass-through requirement to pass through that interest rate reduction to the residents. And those two exceptions are one, which Terry mentioned, was with manufactured home parks, and also for preservation projects which benefit from federal rental subsidies, such as project-based Section 8 or RD rental assistance. And in these cases, the residents don't get the benefit from the lower rents, but what happens is that lower interest rate allows the owner to borrow more, once again resulting in the need for fewer capital subsidies, fewer public subsidies. And I have a story, not quite like Terry's, but of my first manufactured home park that I financed. It's called Green Pastures Manufactured Home Park in Redmond. It's a seniors park, and it was one of the first co-ops. It was the first co-op that I worked at NOAA. And the impact on the seniors living in that park, who came together, formed a cooperative, and for the first time had control over what the rents were on the pads that their homes sat. For the first time, they had security, knowing that their fixed incomes could go far enough to cover their other needs, and that was huge. And the first time I did a property inspection, generally I go, I see a couple units, I'm in and out in about an hour. Everyone at the home park, at the manufactured home park, wanted to take me, show me their units, tell me their stories, and tell me what a difference it made to them. So, in closing, the OHTCs are a huge, huge tool in the Affordable Housing Developers Toolkit. It allows us to do our work. It makes it easier. It's an efficient and effective tool, and we really need more of it to get our job done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joni, quick question on the project in Warrenton, Alder Court. You guys, is HDC purchasing that, or are you in the process of?
No, HDC are consultants, so we're working with the Northwest Oregon Housing Authority.
Okay.
And they are the owner, and will continue to be the owner post-rehab.
Okay, I was curious, like the current average rental rate in Warrenton for a two-bedroom, is it like $850? And what will the comparative rent be with this program?
This is one that benefits from the exemption because it's a preservation project.
Okay.
So all of the residents at Alder Court have Section 8, project-based Section 8 vouchers, and under that program they only pay 30% of their income towards rent, and the remainder of those dollars are federal dollars.
Fantastic. Okay, thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Peluso.
So I thanks for the testimony today. I want to just throw a thank you, a shout out to Human Solutions that I chair that board and have for many, many, many years. And I appreciate you mentioning Rosewood Plaza, a fabulous refurb. As you said, so we, instead of tearing down a building, we refurbished it. That was, we found at the time, it was I was a young police officer, and that building was still there. There were no records of any maintenance to that building that we could find. So it was a great project. It wouldn't have happened without the tax credits. We've worked well with you guys around tax credits for many of our buildings. And again, as you said, that having that dental clinic in there for our young kids, especially as well as the adults, all our schools talk about, you know, if there are a lot of kids that don't smile and it's because their teeth aren't looking right. And so that's just great stuff. So supported 100%, of course, and thanks for bringing it all to our attention.
I know we have somebody else who's going to speak, but I also wanted to make a comment and also give you an opportunity to comment back. We only do these tax credits. They come up for renewal every 6 years. So it's really important that we look at it and not just consider, oh, we'll just continue it as it's been, but look at are there ways that we can tweak it to make it even more effective if we believe that this is a good tool. And so the proposal before us in House Bill 2852 is to increase the cap because we have come really close, and the loans that go out with these low interest loans are out for 20 years, and so they're all at different kind of stages, but we can't do any more if we're at the cap. So that is the idea behind increasing the cap. And I've been wondering and just started having initial conversations about what are the other ways, you know, do you want to look at the length of time of these loans? Do you want to look at, should it just be 4%? Or what if interest rates went up to 8%? You know, do we want flexibility and say it should go up, you should have the flexibility to go up 6%? I know you've been already having a lot of conversations, and you had a task force that looked at the timing and things like that, but we want to benefit from those kind of discussions and see is there anything else besides proposing raising the cap that we should be considering. So several people on this committee have expressed a lot of interest to me in housing in particular. I'm saving Representative Hurd for some of the supply side that have to do with land and permitting and things like that, because I know that's been a big issue in rural areas. But I'm hoping that Representative Meek and Representative Noble would be willing to sit down with and really kind of dig into this tax credit before we as a committee pass it in whatever form, and make sure that this is our one chance every 6 years, that we're doing everything we can to make it as flexible as possible. This and the document recording fee are really the only two designated sources of funding besides whatever we might get out of the general fund for housing, both for construction of new housing, for preservation, for acquisition. It's very small dollars, very tight dollars when you think of the needs of the whole state, where we've got a $17 million cap right now on this. These are very small amounts of money. We want to increase them to the extent possible and make them as flexible as possible. So Representative Noble and Representative Meek, are you willing to sit down with them? Okay, great. Thank you. All right. Any other questions for them? Having said that, any other comments on that? Okay, great. So we have Sean Hubert. And is there anyone else that wants to testify on these two, 2852 and 2070? Okay.
Good morning. So my name is Sean Hubert, and I'm here in two capacities this morning. First, as Chief Housing Officer for Central City Concern, a Portland nonprofit working to end homelessness through coordinated interventions, including housing, healthcare, recovery, and employment services. Secondly, I'm here as the board chair for the Oregon Opportunity Network, a statewide association of over 40 nonprofit community development organizations and housing authorities. Central City Concern is both an affordable housing provider and a federally qualified healthcare center for the homeless. We've been around since 1979 and serve about 13,000 people each year through one or more of our services. We operate about 1,800 units of affordable housing in Multnomah and Clackamas counties and specialize in providing very low barrier and low cost housing to people either homeless or at risk of homelessness. We serve families and singles and operate supportive housing programs for veterans, people transitioning from corrections, and people in recovery from addiction and mental health issues. We also provide culturally specific services for Latinos and African Americans. And the average income of our residents that move in is just about $8,000 per year, so a very low-income population. A lot of attention has been given recently to affordable housing, but all affordable housing is not created equal. Because it requires less public subsidy, all too often the most frequent kinds of affordable housing that gets built is housing affordable to people at 60% of area median income. In Portland, that's about $31,000 per year. And while this kind of housing is needed, it does little to address people living in homelessness or on the precipice of a crisis or in deep poverty and at risk of homelessness. These households need rents more deeply affordable than 60% MFI. And one way of achieving more deeply affordable rents has been the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, which efficiently translates interest savings into directly lower rents for residents. And this is a really critical point, because Oregon needs to focus on more than just a unit production strategy. Oregon needs affordability strategies that respond to critical community needs. We need to be producing units, apartment buildings, and communities that respond to the needs of populations most at risk and most impacted by the affordability crisis we find ourselves in. And the OAHTC has been a very effective tool in helping to ensure that projects include more deeply affordable units and rents that serve a broader spectrum of a community's housing needs. I've been working at CCC for the past 10 years, and I've been working in affordable housing in the state for over 20. And over that time, I've seen the value of the OAHTC program firsthand. I've seen it provide housing for families that otherwise would not have been able to afford the higher rents that would have resulted had the OAHTC credit not been available. It is a unique tool whose sole purpose is to drive at deeper levels of affordability. And at Central City Concern, we have used it to provide rents as low as $390 per month, enabling us to provide housing for people coming off the street and working through addiction or mental health recovery programs, enabling the time to stabilize and then work on improving their income and long-term housing goals. We find ourselves here in the state at a very serious inflection point. We have literally tens of thousands of households moving closer to housing instability due to rents that are rapidly outpacing incomes. In Portland, we've seen too many instances of rents doubling overnight, going from $700 to $1,400 or more per month. And we've been in the top two or three fastest appreciating rental markets in the nation for the past 5 years. And looking across the state, more than half of renters are now rent burdened, meaning more than 30% of their monthly take-home pay is going towards housing costs. And sadly, Oregon is now fourth in the nation in per capita rates of homelessness. And in 2016, over 21,000 kids in our school experienced homelessness at some point in the school year. Again, we need not just a unit production strategy. We need an affordability strategy. And the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit can continue to play a large and increasing role as proposed in this bill. On behalf of both Central City Concern and the Oregon Opportunity Network and our members, I urge you to support House Bill 2582. Thank you. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you for your excellent work. Any questions? Yes, Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In terms of the going back to the rent issue, in some cases doubling, what are the reasons that landlords give for those kinds of increases? Do you have a feeling for that?
You know, you've seen, when you take a look at certain markets in Oregon, you know, Portland's a big one, Central Oregon and the, sort of Bend and Madras and Prineville area, you've seen a lot of in-migration happening. So on one hand, you do have a supply-demand situation just because of the in-migration actually happening faster than unit production can occur. We've also just seen in Portland, something like 95% of the units that have come online in the past 3 years, the average rent of those new units is $1,954 per month. And there's just a reality when you have the market being reset in a wholesale fashion like it has. You know, we've seen in Portland over the last 3 years about 20,000 new units come online, most of which have been at that rent level. That really does provide an ability for landlords to increase their rents. And what also has happened is you've seen unprecedented sales of multifamily complexes happening. That's really raised the value. So you've seen a higher turnover, and you have outside investors that are coming into these markets for the first time and buying with expectation of really resetting to that new normal. So it's a combination of both supply-demand economics as well as opportunistic typically out-of-market investors coming in. And the reality is that Portland was always sort of a tertiary market for a long time. I know, you know, the Bend area was as well. You now see regional, national developers that for the very first time are looking at Portland as a secondary or even primary market for their investments. And that is also driving rents.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like you're pretty familiar with the Portland metro market then. My question to you is that what opportunities do you see with your organization of availability of land or development of land for affordable housing in the Portland metro area? And is it both affordable in purchasing that property along with SEC charges, or what are some of the hurdles that you have to overcome besides financing?
Mm-hmm. You know, in the short term, land prices are definitely going up in Portland. So you're paying more on just a per unit basis for the land. You know, there was a time when we tried to keep our acquisition under, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 per unit in terms of the land cost. It's harder and harder to do that now. So I would say that in terms of how we're looking at financing and how we're talking to our partners, you know, we do need strategies that enable nonprofit developers and other developers that are in affordable housing to be able to, you know, look at more sort of products and funding that enables us to go out and acquire land. You know, right now one of the challenges in the Portland market is there is land out there. You know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, we might be talking about an urban growth boundary kind of a conversation, but right now there is land. The problem is that, you know, for-profit market developers can act faster than we can, frankly. We have, you know, everything from, you know, board issues, you know, on nonprofit side to really a lack of access to quick capital. And so I think part of the strategy we're working with funders on is helping to develop flexible tools and financing mechanisms that can enable us to be out in the market and act quicker.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
What type of incentives could either a municipality, city, county, state provide affordable housing builders, developers to help this transition a little quicker?
You know, I think that one thing that could happen is a lot of, you know, lenders and investors want to make sure that there's a clear path to entitlement, for instance. And so if there was a, you know, quicker process that a local jurisdiction could give some guarantees in terms of what the entitlements are on a piece of real estate or what the use could be, that sort of thing, that could be one thing they could do to help. In the Portland metro area, we're fortunate that we do already have jurisdictions that are offering system development charge waivers and some other things that do drive down the cost a little bit, which does help.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
So a lot of those are at the local level, but as I had mentioned previously, besides the two, this financing piece and the doc fee that can put a little more money in the system, mm-hmm. We are also looking at a lot of the property tax abatements have to be decided at the local level, but you heard the vertical housing piece. I see Gwen Baldwin in the back. There are certain things that we can ensure that local entities can make use of, and then we will be looking at a bill for the capital tax exemption for selling a market rate to a nonprofit housing provider, which gives a little more leverage to them. So we may be seeing you back here for that as well.
Just one other. Thank you. So just to go back to something that you said, you were saying that you don't feel that land availability is a problem right now. I know that in the area south of Gresham, for instance, that's very much the case. The UGB was expanded there, what, 10 or so years ago. So are there other areas that you can point to besides that particular piece in terms of land availability?
Other areas I could point to in terms of?
Other areas that would be like that where development could easily occur if you could pay for the infrastructure. Or is it just basically around the city in general?
You know, in the Portland area, I guess what I can say right now is, you know, the land prices are, you know, the issue that we face is, you know, ideally, you know, you're trying to invest in economically diverse neighborhoods, right? And, of course, in Portland metropolitan area, you know, the closer neighborhoods, the land has really escalated quite quickly and is more constrained in the supply side. So you do have issues there. And, frankly, it becomes a policy issue for the county and the city that are the largest funders. You know, they're going to have, if they want economically diverse areas in those close-in communities, they're going to have to pay for more. You know, their subsidy per unit is going to go up, which means their overall unit production would go down. And so there's a very, you know, challenging policy consideration for those jurisdictions. But once you get outside of that, right now, you know, we are working with a broker, for instance, and, you know, we were over about a week and a half, he identified about 10 suitable properties on the market that we could take a look at. Now they are further out,
right?
But there are still available. So right now, if you set aside the close-in question, we're still finding availability not being a huge option or a huge issue, although the prices are obviously creeping up.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2852 and House Bill 2070, open a public hearing on House Bill 2661, long-term care referral. On this, do we have a sign-in sheet for this? This is a bill that actually I introduced, but I'm not going to get up there and introduce it because there are a lot of people signed up to speak about this, and we've made a lot of progress in the last few months meeting monthly. We will start with, Yes, Cassie, can you please read it? And while you're doing that, I'm thinking, Cheryl, it might be good for you to come up and help kick it off on kind of the big picture. And after that, let's have, I'm trying to figure out how about John Bartholomew and John Mullen? We'll have three that are kind of speak for seniors in general, and then we'll go into some of the stakeholders that have a particular stake in this. So John and John, would you like to come up and join Cheryl? And please give us a summary of the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2661 requires long-term care providers to be certified annually by the Health Licensing Office. The bill specifies professional requirements for long-term care providers, including client assessment standards, client and provider contracts, compliance with the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, completion of background checks, disclosure laws, and continuing education. The bill requires the Health Licensing Office to adopt and regulate rules and becomes operative January 1st, 2018. The bill also declares an emergency and is effective upon passage.
Okay, so Cheryl, please introduce yourself and tell us what the big picture is on this so people understand what this bill is all about.
Happy to do so. Chair Kinney-Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Heemstra. I'm the Deputy Legislative Director for Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum. Your Attorney General and the Department of Justice care deeply about consumer protection issues, especially for our most vulnerable Oregonians. This industry is sort of blossoming at the moment. This industry is long-term care referral agents is what I kind of think of them as. And so what they do, it's kind of like a real estate agent where they find a place for you to live, only in this case it's for, say, an aging parent or an aging friend that needs specific care in a specific facility to be placed in. And so a few constituents brought this sort of growing industry to light and contacted the good chair here, and she has dropped this bill. So a little bit about the process and then a little bit deeper into the problem and the fix we're looking at. So the process, we met in, I think it was December, with a group of folks on that very snowy day and discussed some of the issues. In the weeks following, the chair was able to gather some feedback and then just kind of spit it back out to the group. And at that point, the Department of Justice had taken a look at the bill and given some specific language to the chair. And we volunteered, because we do care deeply about this issue, to kind of continue the work of the work group. On Friday, we were able to host a meeting at the Department of Justice. And I have to tell you, a lot of people care about this issue. We had probably 20 people show up either by phone or in person, and it was a really good meeting. I think we're going to be able to find some common ground here. So two kind of buckets we talked about on Friday. The first is sort of the certificate licensing piece, and the second is disclosure to consumers and how the system kind of works here. Just briefly on the certificate piece, I kind of made an analogy earlier to real estate agents. Real estate agents have their own board. They have all of real estate law, which was an entire class in law school. You know, the law there goes back to the Norman Conquest. I don't think we need that much here. but we do need something. So I'm going to defer to the experts in the area about how these facilities work, what these clients need to work on that piece. The second bucket we took a look at was how the relationship is working here with consumer disclosure, what information is collected, and where it goes. And that's more sort of my area of expertise. I'm actually a certified information privacy professional, and it's an issue that the Attorney General cares deeply about. Back to that real estate agent analogy, like all areas, the internet has changed this industry as well. With a real estate agent, you kind of have your model of your local agent. Maybe, you know, your parents bought a house through this person. They're well known in the community. They know the houses. They know the market. Then on the other side is what I would call maybe the Zillow.com model, where you can go online and you type in an area code, and I want 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, and out it spits all this information. Two different kind of models there. What's happening with these long-term care referral agents is that we've had local people in place for a while, and now we're having the internet model come in. Both provide very good service. Both provide you know, a good expansion of the market. But what's happening with some of the internet folks is it's not quite like Zillow. It kind of looks like Zillow, but what's actually happening here is in order to kind of use the service, they asked you for a bunch of the information for the person you're trying to place. You're trying to make a good placement. Little does the consumer usually know, however, that that information then is kind of, after they've had some discussions with the person, usually spit out to a bunch of the facilities that these internet companies contract with. And so a lot of confusion, and you'll see this in the written testimony that was submitted today, a lot of confusion is arising because of that piece of, whoa, wait a minute, my information about my mom went where? So we talked a lot on Friday about better disclosures about what's happening with that information, how the relationship works between the facility and the internet company that's giving those referrals. You may see in the materials today and may hear today about there's no contract between the person that's getting placed or their you know, son or daughter, whoever's working for them, and the referral agent. It's not like real estate agent where you sign that formal contract and you know for the next 6 months if you sell your house, you know, you're going to be working with them, they get paid. The nice thing about this service is there's no upfront fee to, usually there's no upfront fee to the person that's getting placed, and that's helpful. Usually this is a moment of crisis for folks and they need help and they need it fast. They're already having to come up with a lot of money to get mom or dad placed, right? But I would posit to you for just a minute that there is somewhat of a contract going on here. Bringing you back to law school a second, bear with me. A contract is offer, acceptance, and consideration. So the offer is, we've got a nice website. Would you like to use our search engine? Please give us information. Acceptance, yep, you type your information in. The consideration, I would posit to you, is that information that you're handing over. It may not be money, but it is certainly of value to these folks. And so we just want that consideration piece. We want that to be clear to folks when they're signing up for this service. And we were able to meet on Friday, and I think we're going to be able, hopefully, to get some language on that piece so it's clear to folks. With that, we hope to continue working with everybody, and we're knocking out language as we speak. So with that, I'll turn it over.
Thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, for the record, John Bartholomew, Government Relations Director at AARP Oregon. So I just want to say a little bit about the problem and why we're supporting the work that's being done. As we know, we have a bunch of work to do on this bill. But in general, as a society, we don't plan for long-term care. Once people realize they need to be considering long-term care for themselves or a loved one, they're typically in a crisis situation. A loved one has had a diagnosis, a stroke, something that has really put them into a crisis situation that they've never really thought about. And people generally don't know the difference between an ALF, an RCF, an AFH, or memory care. They don't know how much any of this costs. And they don't even know what questions to ask. You know, we don't have society or conversations in our society about these issues like we do with buying a house or buying a car. And it's more important than those things because this is where we're placing a loved one who's getting care, physical care. It's all about dignity, independence, and quality care. And because of the crisis mode that people are in and the lack of knowledge, it places consumers in a much more vulnerable position than in many other consumer situations. They must be able to trust who they work with and have a choice of who they work with as well. So we at AARP support the creation of some basic standards for consumer protection in this field that is largely unstructured right now. And this bill begins that process, but like I said, there's a lot more work to be done on this. So I urge you to consider the consumer protection angle of this proposal as we move forward with discussions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I think the committee's well aware of our mission to work on behalf of low-income people to achieve justice in the state of Oregon. And so in that regard, the Oregon Law Center has always been interested in and involved in client rights responsibilities, provider rights responsibilities, disclosure. But I want to back up for just a moment and talk a little bit about my previous role as director of Clackamas County Social Services. We were on the forefront with other agencies of changing our long-term care system and emphasizing community-based care. In those early days, I used to say that it was akin to the Wild West. The state decided to create adult foster home as an industry, but didn't want to regulate it at all. So the first regulations actually came from ordinances in Clackamas County and Multnomah County. In those early days, this is in the early 1980s, we contemplated registering referral agencies, and there were really very few of them in those days, but the referral agencies were kind of a primitive kind of model, which involved a person referring people to adult foster homes, and we had some concern that people needed to understand a little bit about doing good shopping for services. So we created disclosure files where people could come in and look and see if there were had been any complaints. My colleague, Mr. Bartholomew, talked about, when you're placing a loved one, our experience was that families oftentimes spent more time contemplating what car to buy than where to place their mother. And this was something we always tried to do further education about. We didn't have the bandwidth, as it turned out, to actually work on the registration process because the adult foster home issues at that time were so time-consuming. But I was very interested in this bill and very happy to see what the Department of Justice has come up with and some of the discussion that's been going on about this. We very much want to be engaged and involved in this and to create a bill that we can be proud of. While Oregon has done some really amazing and wonderful things with long-term care, we have some serious gaps in some of the ways in which services work, and this is one of them. And I think that referral agencies that are doing a good job will be interested to make sure that their industry stays consistent and straightforward and can model good practices and good behavior. So I think this is going to be good for the industry, but most importantly, good for consumers. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Yes, Representative.
Thank you. I have a couple questions. I'm a little confused, and I apologize. I know that we've talked with some of you about this, and I think I understand the cumbersome process. But when you mention consumer fraud or consumer protection, I'm thinking that there's an area that I'm not aware of as possibly some fraud, yet I'm also hearing that there's no cost to the consumer. So in the spirit of protecting seniors, is there some sort of fraudulent practice that's been going on with this that I'm not aware of? I mean, just as a problem to solve?
Chair Kinigai, Representative Noel, I'll take a stab at that question.
Sure.
I think the issue comes when people aren't aware that their information is getting sent out. And so what can happen sometimes is a nephew in Pennsylvania goes online and fills out the information and maybe talks on the phone with his online company. Meanwhile, daughter in Gresham is working with mom and talks with a local person that they've heard of. And then all of a sudden they're both getting referred to the same place. And so it becomes an issue when online company has gotten there first. They maybe just emailed out this information to the facility. Then local person also sees this facility as a good fit. The question then becomes the referral fee. These referral fees are paid by the facility, and so who does the facility pay at that point? A problem that's been arising is some of the local agents kind of have to ask, have you used an online service? If so, we're maybe not able to work with you. So that's one of the areas of harm that we see arising. Another is frequent phone calls. Once your information sort of gets out there, then we've seen a lot of repeated phone calls, maybe even after somebody has passed away or something like that. So that's another area of concern.
And Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Noble, one of the other situations we've heard of is where there might be somebody calling themselves a referral agent who only works for certain facilities. And so you think you're getting somebody who is brokering all your options, but they're not. They're only brokering certain facilities that they've contracted with. And so that doesn't give the consumer really all their options that they're available, and since they don't really know how to work within this field, then they don't even know that they are not seeing all their options.
Or they may own the facility.
Sure. So not to downplay the frustrating part of that, and I've got in-laws and they go through that, but we're not talking about financial fraud of the senior itself, him or herself. It's more of the process, the marketing aspects of different facilities, and then competing interests of some referrals providers. And I just want to clarify the actual risk to the senior and just have a better understanding. So I appreciate your answer.
Right. Well, Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Noble, in those situations, they might be placed at in a care community that would not fit their needs completely. There might be a better one out there, or is more expensive than another care facility as well. For example, if you're not really informed that a care community does not have a Medicaid contract, but you're expecting to spend down to Medicaid in a year and a half, the fact that you would then have to move in a year and a half is bad for the consumer in many ways. I mean, there's physical and financial impact to that as well.
So I think your question also may be addressed by
others,
other panels. Mm-hmm. So thank mm-hmm. you so much. And next we have actually the folks that brought this bill to us, Jamie Callahan, Pamela Reinhardt, and Liz Fisher.
Good
Welcome.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee. We're here in support of House Bill 2661. I'm Liz Fisher, and I'm with a local referral agency in the Portland area. And I'm also president of Oregon Senior Referral Agency Association, or OSRA. And we were formed in 2004 by local referral agencies who share the vision of providing excellent pre-qualified housing options to seniors and their families. We recognize we're one of the only disciplines in the continuum of care with no licensing or certifications. So we set our own requirements to qualify for membership. The requirements are designed to make sure that what we do is right for our clients and not what is right for us. Some of those requirements include meeting our clients in person when possible, so that we know who they are and what care that needs they have, what their financial status is, so we can help plan to find the best place for them. We pre-screen communities and homes. We review violations and survey results. We agree to abide by our code of ethics that was written by OSRA. Unfortunately, we recognize that not everybody acting as a referral agency wanted to become members. That's why we're spearheading this bill. We feel there should be standards for referral agencies statewide to protect vulnerable seniors. We think what is important in this bill is setting standards of business, touring with clients so we can hold their hand through this really overwhelming process, offering referrals to other resources that might help them as well, pre-screening communities so we know what is out there and what might be good fits, and knowing violation and survey results. We think transparency is important. We think it's important to disclose conflicts, such as ownerships in the adult care homes. We always disclose how we are paid. We disclose if we contract with or show all options in the area that are appropriate for our clients. We all agree to abide by a code of ethics, and we all have background checks for our business owners, employees, and contractors. We also think annual continuing education requirements are important so that we're up to date on seniors, our issues that seniors face, such as finance, disease management, ethics, legal aspects, and industry best practices. Senior referral companies play a critical role in an elderly person's life at a critical life transition, which makes it vitally important to have high ethics and standards and licensing or certification for all referrals agencies statewide is important to ensure that they are all protected and treated properly.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Pam Reinhart. I've been in this industry for over 32 years, primarily based in community-based situations and positions. However, 2 years ago, I was blessed with an opportunity to go outside of a community and become a senior referral agent, otherwise referred to as an SRA. I knew this was a great fit for me because I was now going to be able to give seniors a right to choice. I was going to be able to offer them the opportunity to be educated and have knowledge about what is available for them and what might be their best fit. There's many options out there. To some who have driven a Cadillac all of their years may not want to fit in a VW Bug, and vice versa. It's not comfortable, and it probably is not appropriate. I believe in what I do on a daily basis. There's three basic criteria I can bring to my clients. First is education and information. I need to educate my clients, their POA, or their financial responsible party, about what is an assisted living facility, a resident care facility, a home care facility. How might that meet their needs? Or moreover, what if the option would work for them to stay in their own home with in-home care? Who are qualified in-home care agencies that they can work with? And what does that mean for them? or just because they recently have had a diagnosis of mild dementia, does that mean they need to immediately move into memory care? Maybe, maybe not. But again, they need to be educated to their options. And along with this, what are the costs? They can be prohibitive, but there are also costs that can be affordable. It is my job to know and educate my clients and their families, their POAs, and their responsible parties of what their choices are. I also believe that in serving my clients well, I need to know my client. I need to know their diagnosis. I need to know their medications, their activity preferences, their dining preferences. I need to know their behaviors. I need to know their cultural and religious backgrounds so that they can be fit and placed in an appropriate setting that will meet those very, very critical needs to quality of life. Moreover, I also need to know their financial background. Are they going to be spending down their money in the next year and a half? I pride myself on not having to replace one of my clients. Every time a client, a senior, is replaced or retransitioned, their baseline of both memory and physical health is declined. Not always is that baseline coming back to where it once was. I also truly believe that through this overwhelming emotional journey, they need someone to hold their hand, to help be there and support them and know what questions they need to know. This is a crisis moment, oftentimes. And at very best, it is an overwhelming journey. People don't do this every day. They don't know what questions they need to know. They don't know what this looks like. They've often lived in their home for 50 years, and now they're moving to a community where they're having to live with other people. That's a big journey to take all by yourself. The third part I feel I need to bring to my clients to give them justice and right to a knowledgeable choice, I need to know the communities that I'm referring to them. I'm not talking about just communities that I may or may not have contracts with, although we do choose to have contracts with all communities if they're willing to have contracts with us. I need to know, what is the room size of that community? What is the common space size of that community? Is their dining room restaurant style, or is it a daily special? To a business person who's gone to a restaurant for lunch every day, being told here is what you're going to have today may not work for them. They may want that restaurant style. It is my job to know which communities have those options. I also need to know what kind of activity preferences each community offers. Perhaps someone really loves music. Which community offers a lot of music? Maybe they like bingo. Who has bingo once a week and who has bingo every day? Again, these are lifestyle options and choices that can really make a difference in our clients' quality of life. Buses. Do they take a bus in a loop that goes to a doctor's office, or is my client also going to have to change a doctor? Hopefully, we can find them housing where it is near the doctor they're used to going to and shopping that is familiar to them to help keep their daily routine as common as possible. Lastly, in the state of Oregon, what we do is one of the only positions that is not in any way certified, licensed, or regulated. We don't even have criminal background checks, which means any predator, sexual predator, murderer, who walks out of prison today can go and place a senior citizen in a community. We don't have to prove we have knowledge, education of where we're recommending people go. I feel at very least these are two areas that must be required. Seniors, our vulnerable population, need to be protected and should indeed have rights to know that they can trust who's showing them their new home. So in closing today, Madam Chair, members of this committee, I ask you if you were placing your loved one, would you not want to know that you're working with someone that you can entrust because they have education, because they've had a criminal background check? And moreover, do you not want to know that you have a right of who you work with, that you can choose who you work with, that you don't have to be bound by a contract that may be 1 day old, 1 month old, 1 year old, but you can make a choice of who places your loved one in a community? Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the community. My name is Jamie Callahan, and I own a senior referral business in Southern Oregon. I'm probably the newest kid on the block here. I've had my business for just about a year, but I've been in this industry for about 10 years. Senior referral businesses and lead generators are a growing, unregulated industry of professionals advising private pay, older, vulnerable adults and their families about assisted living options. Those eligible for Medicaid have case managers and transitions coordinators with DHS, but the private pay sector is serviced by senior referral businesses and lead generators, which do not always ensure the greatest care possible. The state is regulating fishing guides and music therapists, but senior referral businesses and lead generators go without any certification, required ethics, oversight, training, or background checks. We're not referring 30-year-olds to car lots. These are vulnerable adults whose lives are dependent on the care setting that we refer them to. Without some regulation in this area, there's an inherent public safety concern for the protection of consumers and their families. Sadly, throughout our state, those of us with boots on the ground are observing forms of fraud and abuse all around us, and there's very little that can be done about it today, including the violation of the federal anti-kickback law. Folks in my own hometown are referring for referral fees, kickbacks for Medicaid, and it's not enforceable in the state of Oregon because it's a federal law. Oregon has identified people over the age of 65 as vulnerable adults, yet senior referral businesses and lead generators get away with poor business practices, including referring individuals that they've never met into assisted living communities that they've never even seen. Every case manager and transitions coordinator that I have spoken to at DHS in almost every county in the state of Oregon would agree that it is impossible to facilitate a transition for a senior from any setting without having met with them and have already pre-screened the community that they're referring to. So why is this legal in the private pay sector? Ask yourself, if you live in Oregon, would you call someone in Nevada to ask about an assisted living for your own frail and aging mother? Would you trust what you hear if they've never even seen the place? Seems like a no-brainer. House Bill 2661 protects older Oregonians by requiring that all senior referral agents receive training, get certified, and operate under the same set of measurable standards. It should require that all agents meet with the person to perform an in-person intake and then only refer to assisted living communities that they have physically pre-screened and deemed appropriate. How else do you know if the community is filthy or how many violations have been issued in the last year? Violations in the state of Oregon are only visible in the facility itself or by visiting the local DHS office. The only things that you can view online in its inconsistent format in the state of Oregon are substantiated APS investigations, but that does not count survey results or violations in an adult foster home setting. This issue is compounded by companies that collect name on websites that appear confusingly similar to assisted living communities. Once a name has been collected, these companies own the right to compensation for that name as a lead per contractual agreements made between the community and the lead generating company. The consumer never even knows this is happening and doesn't get a chance to agree to it. This prevents compensation to any local service-oriented senior referral business. As a result, those of us in your area with boots on the ground may refuse to work with you because we cannot get paid. In a nutshell, individuals are unknowingly giving up their names, essentially handing ownership of their name as a lead to an online corporation for an average of 2 years. In exchange, individuals are provided an incomplete list of options limited to the communities that have agreed to pay those companies. It could be 2 out of 50 options in your area. Families are often reaching out in a time of crisis, and it's easy to take advantage of folks who don't fully understand where or how to start when operating under duress. They'd give their information to Hitler if they believed that they could get help when a discharge planner is telling them you have 48 hours to find a place for your mom and she cannot go back home. Help to promote industry standards and regulations to protect those who can fall prey to unethical business practices. It's only a matter of time before this happens in your family if it hasn't already. Protect the right to choose. And when you do, help to make sure they're a certified referral agent.
Thank you very much. I am aware of the clock ticking, so if anyone has a quick question for them, we will be having another public hearing. We will not go straight to a work session because this bill is changing enough that we're going to have more comment on whatever the compromises are that we reach. So don't feel that we're not going to have anyone in the audience, not going to have more chance to have dialogue with people here. Okay, so with that, thank you so much. And we've got Karen Kessel and Camille Cleveland next. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning. Chair Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, my name is Karen Castle, and I'm the CEO of Caring.com, and I am here to express my opposition to HB 2661. Caring.com is an internet-based business founded to support family caregivers. We provide caregivers with online information, support groups, and directories of local resources to make their caregiving journey easier. Our primary source of revenue comes from senior living referrals. We have approximately 120 family advisors that are available 7 days a week to help families learn about the senior care options available to them. The most typical user of our services is an adult child that has suddenly been thrust into the role of caregiver for a parent, either because there has been an accident or some other incident which has caused the adult child to become concerned about their parent living alone. The adult child is typically in their 50s and is often living in another state from their loved one. They usually start their search for help by going online to the internet and Googling something like assisted living Salem, Oregon. If we've done our job well, they will find a listing for caring.com in the search results, and that may lead them to our assisted living directory where they can find ratings and reviews on all the assisted living communities in the area. And that's both those that we have a contract with and those that we don't. For additional free information, they can call a toll-free number or fill out a lead form to reach a caring.com family advisor. If they fill out the lead form during business hours, a family advisor will call them immediately. All of our calls are recorded for training and quality assurance purposes. Caring.com's well-trained family advisors spend between 30 and 60 minutes with the family to help them understand the vocabulary of senior care and what options are available. They also spend time understanding the current situation, the care that the loved one needs, geographic preferences, and the financial resources of the family. Due to federal laws, we do not refer the approximately 30% of people that we speak to that are dependent on Medicaid to pay for senior living. If senior living is a viable option for the family advisor will recommend a handful of communities that meet their requirements and make a referral to the community. We refer only to licensed communities, and we refer families to both communities with whom we have a contract and, in many cases, to those with whom we do not have contracts. Since no family should make a senior living decision without visiting the community, we encourage the families we serve to tour the communities, and our advisors are happy to schedule that tour with them while they're on the phone. After the call, the family is then emailed a confirmation list of all the communities that were discussed on the call, including their name, address, and phone number of the community. Dates and times of scheduled tours are included. There are links to the ratings and reviews on caring.com. And at the bottom of every email, we provide the name and contact information for the advisor they spoke with and a link to a fee disclosure page on our website. This service is entirely 100% free for families, and there is no contract or commitment required on the part of the families. Our only contract is with the senior care communities. Once the communities receive the referrals, they take over from here. They provide the tours, they negotiate the leases, and they conduct extensive state-mandated in-person screenings to be sure that the prospective resident is a good fit for the community. A community is free to reject anyone that they don't feel would be a good fit for their population. After visiting and doing their own due diligence, should the family decide to move their loved one into the community that we referred them to, then the community pays us a referral fee based on the first month's rent. In the event that the community had already been in contact with this family prior to receiving the caring referral and had notified us within 5 business days or such, no referral fee would be due. It is my opinion, and that of thousands of customers, that caring provides a valuable free service to families at a very scary and difficult time in their lives when they have more questions than answers and time is of the essence. Anecdotes aside, I am not aware of any statistically significant problem that needs to be addressed by the legislature. In fact, our consumer satisfaction rating by an independent third-party surveyor gives Caring.com a rating of 4.5 out of 5 stars based on over 6,000 respondents. We are and always have been committed to consumer protection and transparency. We agree with the provisions in the bill that truly support these values, such as fee disclosure, making referrals only to licensed facilities, and maintaining high levels of business insurance coverage. However, the provisions of this bill suggesting in-person assessments and in-person screenings of all long-term care facilities are directly discriminatory against internet-based agencies and would work to legislate the internet-based business model out of existence and eliminate consumer choice. In closing, it is my opinion that any legislation is premature and costly, and that this bill specifically is discriminatory, fraught with misunderstandings about the role of referral agencies, and will lead to limited services for Oregon's families. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Karen. Do you want to wait till after the other person? Or?
It was more specific to hers.
Okay.
So sorry. Yeah, just had a quick question. You said that your clients have a rescission period, that you said right before if they gave you notice that they wanted to use somebody else's services, they can give you a notice. I just wanted to make sure I didn't.
Yeah, so
miss that.
We help about 8,000 families a month, and we've been doing that for about 4 years. And in those 4 years, this issue has come up 3 or 4 times. So it almost never comes up. The 3 or 4 times that it has come up has always been the result of one very aggressive national referral agency, which franchises locations across the country. And in those 3 or 4 instances, it was not the family that asked to rescind their information. It was this company who sent us a form letter demanding that we delete this family's information. It wasn't even signed by the family. And those are really the only 4 cases where this has ever come up.
But it is your policy that you...
If we heard from the family, if the family asked us to delete their information and stop working with them, we would certainly comply with whatever the family asked us to do.
Okay, great. I just wanted to clarify that. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Camille.
Thank you. Chair Kenny Geyer and committee members, my name is Camille Cleveland, and I work for A Place for Mom. We are a nationwide internet senior referral agency. We've been in business, started in the state of Washington in 2000. We do business proudly in Oregon. We have 5 employees here who help families, but our model is an internet-based information system that the consultations are done over the phone. We do not tour families. We have a large platform of only licensed communities where they need to be licensed, and we do check those licenses and any violations twice a year to make sure that that they are still valid. Our senior living advisors operate much like the and obtain much of the information that the local communities obtain. The difference is they do it over the phone. It's a wide landscape, the senior living referral industry and the senior living industry itself. It's not one size fits all. Some people, particularly if it's a son or a daughter, may want to use more of an internet-based model and phone. Give me the information, and I'm going to go take my mother to tour. Other people need a lot more hand-holding, and that's why I think it's great that both the local senior living referral agents who I know do a great job for their clients, and internet-based companies, which also do so, are both represented here. We are not, we are opposed to HB 661 as written, but we've been working since the snowy day in December on a possible compromise that might achieve the goals of everyone. We certainly support the goals of transparency and disclosure. Just recently, we worked for over 2 years with Senator Mendoza in California to draft a bill that contained much of the same type of disclosure and transparency information, and we're in full support of that type of bill. Of course, we do not agree with the in-person assessment, and I think we've already talked about whether there might be a compromise on that. It would essentially put the internet model out of business in Oregon and reduce consumer choice. In addition, our senior living advisors are not they're not doctors, and they're not in a position where they can assess medical needs. That is appropriately done at the community level. They need to be assessed before they're admitted to the communities. We're working with the industry groups, and I think cooperatively. I think there's a common ground here. I think we all have, we all share the same goal of it really enhancing the noble goal of senior living. And I think as long as we focus on accountability and transparency, then we can all find a bill that we can agree to, one that includes background checks, sending only to licensed communities, insurance limits, and also designating senior living referral agents as mandatory reporters for purposes of neglect and abuse. These are standards that A Place for Mom operates under nationally, even though there is no requirement for us to do so. We look forward to working with the DOJ and again with your committee, Chair Kenny Geyer, and finding out how we can get to this common ground about transparency and disclosure without unnecessarily removing a very important resource for families from the market. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. The only other person to sign up, and I think hopefully you can say this in 30 seconds, what I think you want to say, is Sylvie Donaldson from Health Licensing Office. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And
okay, keep it short. Chair Kenny-Geyer and members of the committee, I'm Sylvie Donaldson. I'm the director for the Health Licensing Office. While the office is neutral on this bill, I just kind of want to talk a little bit about how the bill is going to impact the office. The bill currently is written. I understand there's work going on it. It is very vague. There's not a lot of details of what a qualifier of a person is. Again, we address who can have this license, who should have this license, not the piece about actually what they do when they work, other than here's what you can't do and we can cite you for that. One of the things, and not saying that the office can't do it, we can address all the vague stuff. We do rules advisory committees, have a lot of meetings. However, having it implemented by July or January 1 of 2018 might be a stretch if the office is assigned with writing the rules for the assessment of clients and the health concerns and issues. Doesn't say we can't do it, it's just 6 months is a little short to have a bunch of rules advisory committee meetings, put the rules out for public comment, and get them in place by January 1.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Because I thought what you were going to testify was that you thought it might be better placed at DHS and not in Health Licensing Office at all.
This is Sylvie. That is entirely up to you guys.
Okay.
What we do is we focus on licensing individuals, DHS, and because we have the nursing home administrators, so we license the administrator, they license the nursing homes.
Okay.
We are focused more on the individual and the individual's qualifications for a license, the individual's responsibilities once they have that license, not the homes, not the community.
Right.
It's more of the individual holding the certificate.
Okay, great. Any questions? I'm going to say a couple of closing comments. I see there are other people that didn't sign up that might want to say something, but I'm actually going to ask for you to wait until another time because we do have a visitor from out of state who's coming here to talk about the caring community. And, you know, we tend to go over because we only have two meetings a week, and this committee used to have three, and I'm just finding it impossible to fit things into two. And I respectfully ask that we give the next speaker, you could go, thank you, some time. And I also respectfully ask, and you all can get back to me after this, to stay until 10 o'clock because I've considered adding a third session, and I'm trying to avoid that. And I think if everyone can try to just not schedule anything else until 10 for times when we might go over. So we just have so much in this committee, and bills continue to come in. So if that is okay. I'll just say a couple things before we turn it over and before I close this. You know, I think we had meetings in December, January, and then February, and there's been enormous focus on this. I think it is an underregulated area. It's a very important area. I appreciate this having come forward, and I think that we've already found a lot more compromise than you would see in just the bill. We don't have an amendment out, so you can't see that progress, but there are certain areas that while we may not have general agreement, I think it's fairly clear it's moving in the direction of not allowing for one business model and not allowing for the second business model. We're trying to find a way where we can have both business models, the internet model as well as the kind of, you know, warm hands on the ground. And in both of those areas, we know that there's things that we can do to increase the quality of care. And the people who are coming to the table and talking about this are the ones that really care about that. And I think there's been a lot of common ground in concern about some of the, you know, shingles that are held up there that may be people on the ground but are not a part of the association here, which has established gold standards. So how do we make sure that we have appropriate gold standards and disclosure and consumer choice for people, whichever model that they're operating in? So I think I think it's pretty safe to say we're not going to go forward with the piece that's probably most alarming to some, which is the requirement you have to meet in person. But I think there are areas where we've already found a lot of common ground. I think one of the probably bigger sticking points right now is there a right to rescind? I think that is one of the places that we've not found common ground. But there's been enormous common ground already. I'm really pleased with the progress, and I want to thank everyone who's been a part of that, and particularly Cheryl from DOJ, who has facilitated it and said, do you need help facilitating this? I'm like, yes. And I'd also like to know, based on this conversation, if any of you are really interested in being a part of this conversation as we continue to work out. I feel like we've probably gotten to about 80% of the areas that were on the table where there was some disagreement, and now there's a lot of agreement, and then there's probably 20% left. But if anyone here in this committee is interested in joining that conversation, that would be great. So, Mark, okay, great. So I'm going to close the hearing. Thank you so much, everyone, on House Bill 2661, and open our informational meeting on caregiving with Laura Dresser from the University of Wisconsin. Thank you for coming this far. And we are officially end at quarter of, but I think anyone that can stay, you have at least 20 minutes. A little longer if there are questions.
Representative Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, thank you for having me here. I am from Wisconsin, but in fact my family lives in Oregon, so I'm getting to visit them in McMinnville and escape actually what usually would be miserable weather in Wisconsin, but in fact is really lovely, strangely lovely weather in Wisconsin right now. So thank you for having me. My name's Laura Dresser. I'm the research director at a place called the associate director at a place called the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, COWS, at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. It is a good little joke for the people of the state of Wisconsin. The further I get from the state, the more pity I seem to have people. But I appreciate that you laugh, so that's good. That's a good sign. We don't do anything about agriculture. I, in fact, mostly do work on the economy. I have a PhD from the University of Michigan in economics and social work, and I have focused mostly on low-wage service sector jobs. Over the course of my 20-year career, I have looked a lot. You can't look at low-wage service sector jobs and not see care work. And by care work, I mean both child care and hands-on health care work, the work where we take care of people at their most vulnerable moments, we build people up, we help people as they decline. That is the work that is so consistently undervalued and unseen, so consistently underinvested, so central to our public good and the topic of this paper. I did a paper that had a kind of national set of data in it. Some people here saw that and invited me to work with other people, a couple other researchers here in Oregon, to produce this report on Oregon's care economy. These were dropped off at all your offices and will make fine gifts to your family members that otherwise be useful to you. And so let's just, I will do this quickly. I know you're... we're time sensitive, but I guess where I want to start this is to think about what I'm including here and why I'm putting all this stuff together. I know you are in healthcare, and healthcare, you are paying attention probably mostly to the senior side. I pay a lot of attention both to the child care side and the senior side because I see one problem. I see a problem of undervalued workers, stressed families, inaccessible and inaffordable care. It's the same problem, and it's not exactly the same problem, and you know there's different systems relating to that problem, but it generates a very similar set of problems. It is so essential to life in Oregon, to everyone's life. The quality of the care they know that loved ones are getting is what makes them feel secure in the jobs they do. The quality that workers are able to provide is what makes them feel good about the work they do, and the quality of the care that's received is what really makes life an enormous difference in life at people in vulnerable moments. There's 70,000, so we'll do a little data, a little thinking about what investments might look like, and a little bit about what policy options there are. Just quickly, there's 70,000 workers in care work in this in the state of Oregon. The bulk of those are in home health and or institutional care for the elderly or agency care for the elderly. About 20,000 home health and personal care workers, about 36,000 in different forms of institutions, from nursing homes on through CBRFs of different sorts. Another 14,000 child care workers. So that's that 70,000 worker workforce. And across all these different kinds of institutions, this is probably pretty hard to see, but is available in the document. Basically, these workers, whether they're working at child care centers or working at nursing homes, et cetera, they're earning roughly $10 an hour, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. And they mostly don't have much by way of benefits, bad jobs, bad packages. So low wages almost always come with almost no benefits. Health insurance, rare. Pension, non-existence, sometimes even sick leave is a hard thing to get on vacation. The question of hours also makes the home health side variable and very hard to generate decent income off of. You've got low wages and then variable hours and all the volatility of your clients' whims or health or vacation or whatever, all that volatility on the worker, meaning that every time someone's sick or goes on vacation or doesn't want to see you, the hours you counted on working don't. You don't get to work, and you don't get paid for. I've put up a story of a, there's quotes throughout the book of the voices of different care workers. This is this voice of a care worker who was not, who left the child care industry because she simply could not make ends meet. And I think that's a common story there. Disturbingly common story. You can see that from a number of perspectives. I just wanted to draw attention to the profiles that are also in the report. But I think what I want to say is that if you look at this industry from any angle, you're going to see stress. There's really three kind of positions to look at the healthcare economy from. The first position to look from is from the perspective of someone who wants to purchase care, a parent of a kid, or an older person who needs care for themselves, or someone who needs care for a family member. And you look into this industry, you discover it's expensive, the quality is variable, and the provider may turn over a lot. Right? And so you are stressed as you look at this industry because of the costs, because of the instability in the quality, because you're stressed anyway, because somebody very important to you is very vulnerable and you need to buy care that that you're not able to provide because of other demands. But from another perspective, you have the perspective of the worker themselves. And as they look at this industry, they tend to see work that they really love and really value, but that does not particularly pay enough to allow them the stability and the kind of consistency of care to stay in the job. To reward their skills, like for Lindsay with the 4-year college degree, probably not even getting above $12 or $13 an hour, when you could flip over to the public schools and get a real wage, right? So from the perspective of the worker, also a kind of sense of I would like to be here, but there's an insufficient reward. And then from the perspective of the person who's getting care, that child, the person, the vulnerable person, the disabled person, a kind of making and breaking of relationships, right? Or a connection to someone who's distracted by their own concerns, or hasn't been in the job long enough to know where equipment is, or all sorts of things that happen over time. Because care work is about relationships. Turnover is much more costly, right? And so it's a high turnover industry. That is very destructive, especially for the person receiving care. So you know the kind of issues of cost. I want to highlight one cost issue is that infant care at $14,000 a year, full-time infant care, if someone earns roughly the median wage, which would be probably $16, $17 an hour in the state, $7 of an hour would be going directly to the child care, right? That's impossible in the context of rent, basically. Almost impossible. Depends on the family. But at the median, high-quality child care is almost impossible. All right. I think there's a lot of evidence that investing in care as a public good, thinking of care as important to workers and providers and recipients, systematically, the way we do when kids turn 5 and are magically a public good worth investing in through the public schools. If we kind of imagine that as worthy as they are at 5, they are at 3, and that we made sufficient and significant investments in the care infrastructure, there's a lot of payoff to be found there. One is the increasing evidence about the investment in brain development and early childhood, high quality care really paying off in the long term for the kids in that care, but also as an economic development tool. Investing in the care economy is like an investment in women, because women so often carry the burden of care, family care, so that when the kid's sick, when the kid's born, when the parent needs intense care, often women break their careers. They step out of the labor market. They reduce hours. They delay promotions in order to take care of their care. And that puts more between them and their paid employment. More investment in care allows them to invest more in their paid employment, and that pays off broadly in the economy as well. And also, because this is essentially a private system that is very expensive, it weighs most heavily on the lowest income families in the state. And so the families that have to carry the burden both of paid care at low-wage, at paid care while they are in low-wage jobs, some of them in low-wage care jobs, in fact, to solve the care problem actually disproportionately helps them because these costs are so intense, they are almost unsustainable at the lowest levels. So equity on the gender front, equity in terms of income inequality, stronger economic growth, all possible, but not in a hodgepodge system of no systemic solutions. The last slide is just a bit on what a system looks like, thinking systematically about helping families provide care in the most intense instances. That's paid family leave, something the U.S. basically doesn't do, but the rest of the planet does. Making high quality, you know, paying attention systematically to senior care and child care in different settings that is affordable and accessible. And then in that context, paying very close attention to the quality of jobs. The workers are the quality of the jobs and the skills required and supported in those jobs. That moving all those three things together is a system rather than just kind of throwing at this constant crisis, which will only grow because we know these are fast-growing jobs, low-paid jobs, high-turnover jobs already. You have to think about the worker, the client, the consumer, all the time when you're trying to fix this as you go forward. And that is the paper.
Great.
Questions?
So I have an overall question. There are states that do better than others in child care subsidies and ERDC, employment-related daycare. There are states that some states have paid family leave and or paid sick leave. Other states don't. Are there any states that you point to that have that are out ahead of others in terms of the combination of those things or in terms of a greater vision that they're working toward?
You know, I tend to know the hodgepodge. I know who the leaders are. You know, so California and New Jersey have the paid family leave. Others, Colorado and Washington State on the heels, sort of in different ways. The quality rating systems, again, across the board, probably less attentive, a handful are attentive to wages. Although the quality rating systems are a very hard way to drive wages because it's such a subset of the total child care population. So even, you know, so I know there's leaders in that, but still you're not going to get to the systemic solution. And then, as you know, leaders all over different states who are way out in front in terms of consumer-directed care for seniors and how and, you know, sort of rebalancing away from nursing homes, et cetera. I don't see... And I know there's advocates all over the country working hard on this, but I haven't seen a comprehensive, you know, state approach. Maybe you.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to be that. Okay, any other questions? Thank you for coming and introducing your report, and I'll be eager to look more into it now that we've had the big picture.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, with that, close the informational meeting on caregiving and close our House Committee on Human Services.